Welcome to Late Night Writers. On this episode, we talked to Stacey Westfall, and wow, what a podcast.
I have never really looked at everything Stacey has done before, but I'm telling you, this girl, she is not only sweet, but boy, does she know about horses. I'm sure there's people listening will get so much to gain from what she said.
And she's so accomplished. In 2006, mm-hmm. she won the Road to the Horse and the All-American Quarter Horse Congress freestyle reining competition.
I mean, a wonderful person and an accomplished equestrian.
Very much.
Mm-hmm.
So you can find her podcast on her website, staceywestfall.com. And be sure to like and subscribe to our podcast.
I think you'll really like this one.
Enjoy. Welcome to Late Night Writers. I'm Gretchen, and I'm joined by my mom, Kristen, Grandma, Debbie, and Janaea, and Stacey Westfall.
Hey, Stacey.
Hello.
Hey.
So, Stacey, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, boy. we'll go with the short version. I am Stacey Westfall, and I teach people how to successfully train and enjoy and understand their own horses better, and I'm probably best known for either winning the Road to the Horse competition or probably arguably the bareback bridleless freestyle ride. That one spread a little wider. So yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Road to Horses competition?
Yeah, it's a colt starting competition that has been going on now for a little over a decade, and basically, they bring in a group of people that are going to be starting the colts, clinicians, trainers, different people, and they then have you select from a group of like very, very lightly handled horses, meaning they may have been halter broke as weanlings, but then they're pretty much untouched. And then you have the job of starting them in front of a crowd of people in a very limited amount of time. It's varied a little bit. The year I did it, we had 3 hours to train them. And, you know, it's gone, you know, they've modified it up and down because it's been kind of a learning process. But yeah, it's basically a really short time period to show what you can achieve with a virtually untouched horse, like a very, very, very green horse. Yes. Yeah. And at the end of it, the challenge is to ride through an obstacle course, and you're judged on the training in the round pen, and then you're judged on the actual final course too, and basically how you handle it.
So what was like going through your head when you were announced as the winner of that competition?
You know, it's kind of interesting because as most good stories, like that piece of the story was a teeny tiny piece of what was going on that weekend. Because I have 3 kids, and at the time, they were roughly right around the ages of like 7, 6, and 4.
Wow.
And they're all boys, and they were with us, and it was my first, like, it was my biggest public event type thing. Totally had no preparation going into it to understand how long the lines of the crowds were going to be and all the stuff. And everybody got sick. So the kids were really sick. And the kids were like, and I remember that Tootie had gotten us a room that had a jacuzzi in it, like as a special treat with the little kids. And we were using it as like an ice bath cooling area because everybody was so sick. We had directions to the hospital because the fevers were like hovering around like 103, 104. And you were like, they're really sick. You know, and I was being like, I want to be mom, so I'm doing, and so I wouldn't let the grandparents do as much as I should have let the grandparents do, looking back, but I was having that trouble, that challenge of being like, mom on one hand, and person competing over here on the other hand, and being like, I could do it all. And basically, I got done, so I was like, I did my round, I wish I had a video, I did my round, and then I went to the VIP lounge and just laid down. And like, I'm just like, flat on a couch, and then like they came up and they got, like, I didn't even watch the other competitors, and they came up and they got me and they took me down, and it was just surreal because with all of that going on, mm-hmm. it was announced, it didn't feel real, Plus, like, when I got in the truck the next day, I just laid my head down on the seat in between, and I was like, I don't think I feel good. Oh, and I went home and went to the doctor, and they were like, you have bronchitis. You need to go down. Yes. You need to, like, go down for the next, you know, you can't do anything. And I was like, that's nice. I'm supposed to be in Canada on Friday, and we're going. You know, the horse world, we are very, I think, they say that, you know, I listen to Dave Ramsey, for example, and he's like, yeah. I love kids that have been farm raised because they have great work ethic. But some days I'm like, maybe our work ethic, maybe we should have slowed down. Like,
yeah. I think about that because I say, you know, we never quit and we never show that we hurt or whatever, you know, but I think that would be a good thing to talk about sometime because we're just not quitters at all. But that had to be a lot for you, poor thing. You had to be exhausted. Oh my.
On the other hand, I think it was mixed blessing because, you know, I don't know if you've ever noticed when you get sick or really like when everything, you focus on only what's necessary. Like, so a lot of the other stuff that seems like it's so big, when you get real sick, you go down to like, I need to do these three things.
Yeah. I was going to ask you if you thought that maybe that played a part in it with you having to kind of just redirect your focus on that for the moment, you know, while you were probably thinking about your kids, but, you know, still having to just do that process of taking that colt into that. What did you have to do to actually prepare for that then? Did you do like this with a bunch of other colts or how did you do that?
Yeah. So in hindsight, I'm pretty sure I probably made myself sick due to stress and anxiety and that kind of stuff, like not handling that. If you look back, my career was going well. And then in 2003, I rode a horse bridleless for the first time at the NRHA Futurity. And that like, that kind of popped me into the spotlight in a way I'd never been before. And then in 2006, that's the year that I did the Road to the Horse and the Live Like You Were Dying ride. And so for me, everything was like, it was growing really fast. And I don't think I was as prepared as if it had grown slower. And so, so I think that was a piece of it. But what I had done, because I didn't know how to prepare for the colt starting piece of it, I mean, I'd already been starting colts, but it was the time frame. So when I had applied, I had actually, they were like, they had said, if you wanted to apply, send in a video. And I was like, I have no idea what to video. So the next colt that came in, I just set a video camera on a tripod and started the horse inside the same frame, time frame that I would be required to at there. And sent that in, and apparently it worked because there I show up. Well, when I got to go, what I did was about, you know, maybe a month ahead of time, I called a bunch of my customers that had horses that needed to be started. I'm like, hi, can you send? So I started 8 horses within the same time frame. And again, I've always joked around that I'm really bad at math. And so I like had them all come in the same week.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my God. Like, why? Yeah, just... I was doing like, okay, you get, because at the time you got 1 hour on Saturday in the competition on when I was doing it, you got 1 hour Saturday, 2 hours Sunday, and then you had to ride your obstacle course.
And wow.
So at home with those 8, I was like, okay, you get one, like I'm doing U4 today and U4 the next day. So that's like, you know, and it was like, it was insane. Like, but I learned a lot because what you basically are doing is you're just trying to like, let's just say there's 100 steps to starting a colt from the time that you, you know, teach it to lunge to the time that you get on its back. And just for a number, say there's 100 steps. Basically, when you go to something like that, you're going like, what are the key 20? What are the critical, like, we're going to say they're all, but you're just trying to laser focus it. Wow. So
I just have to say, you're just such an overachiever. And I just can't believe, like, I was listening to, I believe it was one of your podcasts because I've listened to quite a few things, but you were just saying, well, since I don't really exercise too much, I decided that I would do yoga, running, and weight training. And then, you know, I told my mother, and she's like, and, you know, like you said, out of this came a very good thing, a 5K that you didn't expect. And then you told your mother that you were doing this, and I think she believed she said something along the lines of that, oh, you're signing up for one? And it's like I'm thinking, this girl is like, she's probably riding horses 8 hours a day, doing all these things. And I'm like, this girl is absolutely an overachiever. So you are amazing. It's pretty interesting.
Well, thank you. Back when we used to train horses full time, it was common to ride horses for 8 or 10 hours a day. And I was younger and it just kind of all worked. And then, you know, the way that we've morphed the business, I do more teaching and clinics, and I ride pretty much my own personal horses. So my goal is 4 horses a day. So I'm roughly right around 4 hours a day. But I also have this theory that, there is a little bit of your body must have a familiarity. I mean, I'm sure, but I think you can get efficient at doing something. They say you have to change your exercise routines because your body gets accustomed to something. So that's a little bit of what I experienced. I think something between aging and my body changing it, you know, I just remember a massage therapist going like, "You're not 20 anymore." Oh. And I was like, that I guess I could think about that. And so there's things that change just from, you know, age. And then there's also things that change from, I'm not riding 8 to 10 hours, I'm doing this. And then maybe there's also just some like better balance maintenance going on now that was maybe not even there when I was 20.
Well, I have to say too, from listening to your podcast and things, how much we all appreciate your practicalness, how you take what you do with your horses and relate it to common things that make it so easy for us to understand. And I just want to thank you for that. It just really helps a lot to hear that you relate it to your children or to, you know, I love like in your book, in Smart Start, how you talk about like the ages of the horses, like being either like college age or high school age or younger. And that just helps so much to understand.
Yeah. I think some of these, thank you. I think some of these things are hard to anchor. And I really, really, really believe that when you want to test a principle that you hear and it's brand new, if it's a strong principle, it's a life principle and it will run through life. The common thread of whatever somebody's teaching you, you should be able to discern what that common thread is. Mm-hmm. And then you should be able to apply it, that common thread you should be able to apply across life. It should fit with, you know, across the board. And I think that that's, you know, I think that helps you know that you're onto something that's solid versus something that could be a fad. And, you know, because there's going to be a ton of different presentation techniques, meaning, you know, I'm going to phrase something one way, somebody else is going to phrase something the other. If you want to look for the differences, you're going to find differences because you're looking for what's not the same. If you look for the common thread, it is worth gold because the common thread not only will help you with the horses, but it's going to resonate across life through marriage, through exercise, through finances, through everything. And that's what makes me excited. So I try to pull those ideas back and forth to be able to show people that's how I'm testing things.
That's what I really liked. You talked about the mistakes and as long as you're moving forward in mistakes. So you sound like you're, you know, really accomplished and, you know, you could probably be a perfectionist, but it also sounds like you are balanced in how you take care of things because you are like saying, you know, as long as you're moving forward within the mistake and you are looking at that mistake and moving, you know, like you talk about how many days it would take to be with the horses and things like that. As I was listening, I'm thinking you're not giving advice just for horses or a certain discipline. You're giving advice for life, you know, and anybody could listen to you, your podcast. Mm-hmm. They are really, really good.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Thank you. I still think the best book title I've ever read is the book Failing Forward, which is a phenomenal book, but it's also just a phenomenal title and thought, like Failing Forward. I mean, And I am a recovering perfectionist who probably does keep a little bit of overwhelm in my life because if you keep going forward, there's a limit to how perfect you can make it. Because the temptation, if you're a perfectionist, is to not move forward because you want to stay right here and make it perfect. And so it has to feel, a lot of times for me, it has to feel like it's 80% done and then I need to go because if I allow myself to go 100% done, I'm talking to you on my MacBook Air that I literally pondered for 2 years. My husband was like, go buy the computer. Get the computer. And I was like, but what if I need this? And what if I need this? And how about that? Yeah. And he's like, just stop.
You're a Dave Ramsey girl. We can tell.
Yes.
So one of our viewers wanted to know, you talk about consistency in the message of training your horses. So what are some tips on how to maintain that? She finds herself getting off message with her horse, and he reacts in different ways to the same request. Once he starts getting inconsistent, she starts to get inconsistent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for me, I have to take that and almost put it into an example. So a lot of times what happens is maybe somebody goes out to work their horse and they're like, I'm going to work on lunging my horse. And so they go out and they go out to lunge the horse and they send the horse to the left, and the horse starts going around, and then the horse asks a question. Now, when I say asks a question, what that looks like is the horse turns into face you. And then half the time the riders go like, oh, did I do something wrong? And they doubt themselves versus sending the horse. Well, then because they doubt themselves, they kind of withdraw back off. And then they're not sure, like, oh, did I do that? Well, I want him to come to me. I don't want to be mean and chase him away, but I don't want to but I didn't ask him to stop. So now they're not as sure. So sometimes when I talk about consistency, you have to try to separate. And this is why in the podcast, I started with the rider's mind, and then I went to the rider's body, and now I'm going to the horse's mind and then the horse's body. So we can break into these four things, because in that little scenario I just put together, the inconsistency comes from the doubt happening in the mind and the question happening in the horse's mind. So we're both in the mind. We're in the horse's mind, like, hey, yesterday you stopped at the end and I looked at you, so can we stop now? And so we're in the horse's mind is asking a question, and the rider's mind is like, oh golly, did I do something wrong? Like, so now we're both in the mind, and I go like, make it trot 10 times. Make it trot 10 times. That's it. Like, you know, while you're trying to make it trot 10 times, the horse is going to still turn in, and you're still going to go like, did I do something? And then you're going to go like, it doesn't matter, because Stacy said trot 10 times. And if the horse breaks to a walk, you're going to have to start again. So at my clinics, I'll be like, and if he breaks to a trot at number 6, it's 0. And we start at 1, 2. And all of a sudden they're like, now the rider starts to be like, we need, like, okay, we're at lap 16. Do not break gate, because she's going to make me go again. And like, and so I try to pull them out of their heads, back into their body, and be like, trot 10 times.
Yeah.
And then when we achieve the trot 10 times, you stop. And now we can decompress and think, did you feel guilty when he looked at you? Did you feel mean when you sent him? How did you feel when you made him do that? I mean, he's breathing. Now he's breathing like, do you feel mean? Because if you feel mean, this is like, we're training an athlete. And we're also training, like, just even if you don't want to say an athlete, it's just like when the kids were little and they needed to work out, like they needed to move. They can't, our kids had to do, we did a system where we said, you can play, you have to earn your video game time. So you need to do an hour of activity to earn 30 minutes of video time. And so there was something like that. But with our horses, we feel so guilty sometimes when we put them to work.
Yeah.
And make them breathe hard. And it's like, no, they like, they didn't read an exercise book, and they're not out there doing work around the pasture, and they're not required to forage over the next 200 miles to get their food. So we got to balance out all the good stuff we're giving them.
Right.
So that in the to answer the question just a brief bit shorter is like, try to figure out where that inconsistency is coming from. 9 times out of 10, it's happening in the mind. And then I just pull it into some kind of a maintainable exercise that's going to make them have to do that. Could, if it's not on the ground, it can be, you know, trot a 20-meter circle 5 times. Mm-hmm. And you're going to start to, because of that consistency, you'll start to notice they're pulling towards the gate on one side, and on the opposite side, they're falling in. How are you going to answer that question? Do, you know, it this is how I look at it.
Yeah. It's almost nice. Like a, it just, you're, what you say makes so much sense to me because I'm a, I was a early childhood care, preschool teacher. Yeah. And then I had children and then I was always a early childhood, but it's a redirection. And it makes so much sense because you are totally just doing a redirection, getting them away from that. And how simple is that to just mm-hmm. before they go into either, you know, like into a temper tantrum or, you know, you know, it's going south. You just redirect. So that, uh-huh. that makes a lot of sense.
You'd be a good trainer then, Kristen. That's really good.
So I actually have a really big question for you. Okay. With that inconsistency, how do you not get frustrated with not getting the response that you hoped for?
Well, the words in there that are key are frustrated and hoped for, because I think a lot of times people are, it's funny. So let's just say that we take a tiny human and grow it for 18 years. And then we're still as parents, like, oh geez, I'm not even sure if you're ready to go. like there's still like this, you know, and it's like, it's a slow process to learn. Well, with the horses, it happens faster, shorter lifespan. They mature much quicker, obviously, like they're up and running. So they've got this really quick, takeoff time mentally in the way that they go. And then it's a different plateau. So it's not the same arcing curve. So that's why I talk about in one of the podcasts, the horse's path is not the same as the rider's path and some of these different things, concepts. So, what a lot of times people don't know is like the actual, a more realistic timeline. So one of the projects I did a while back was the Stacy's Video Diary Jack. And it was a YouTube series where I tracked a year's worth of training with a horse. Mm-hmm. And it actually represents kind of what I was just saying. So we videotaped every day the first 7 days, because when a 2-year-old comes into me, they're so ready to, they're so ready mentally to go that we videotaped every day the first 7 days. And then we went to, like, I forget now if it was 2 or 3 times a week for the next, you know, couple months. And then it tapered down. Because with my skill, because I've been doing this for a long time as a professional, I could do a lot of that kind of quickly there. But even I hit a plateau where there's that quickness to the beginning, but then there's just a plateau to doing a lot of those little Q&A, question and answers. And there's jokes. I mean, how many jokes have you seen on Facebook about circles, circles, and more circles? Like any version of that. You can see it in every discipline.
Yeah,
because what professionals know is that on those circles and circles and more circles, to the untrained eye, it looks like we're just mindlessly going in circles. But to the rider riding it, it feels much more like, imagine your car had a misalignment that you could only adjust while driving it and making an adjustment to it as you were driving. And because you're doing that, like these little minor adjustments where the horse, like, people notice if they're riding a circle to the left and their horse drags them to the gate and out the gate. But technically, when you're riding around and you want to be on this line and you end up 2 inches off that line, the horse is dragging you to the gate. It's just not as magnified as it will be 3 months from now. So what happened, the feel to understand that 2 inches is as important as that 20 feet to the gate. And so because they're like, I made it past the gate. They're like, cool, I made it past the gate. When do we slide and spin? And you're like, there's a lot of detail in there. So a lot of times it's as the people get deeper into the detail work, then they start to understand how much time it takes. And all of a sudden you get real excited about little progress. But here's a very short answer to what you just said. A long time ago, a professional trainer named Dick Pieper had a younger rider come ride with him. And he was watching this younger trainer try to achieve a whole bunch real fast. And he asked the younger rider, do you think you can improve your horse 1% a day? And the younger rider said, sure, 1% a day seems good. And Dick said, then you're a better trainer than I am, because you could train a horse in 100 days.
Wow.
1% doesn't seem like much, But it takes, on average, if you look at a lot of these competition futurity type horses, whether or not you believe in that, they're taking 2 years with a professional. That's a lot of time, little tiny bits of improvement that is so incremental that when a lot of people come to watch me, they're like, you just look like you're riding in a circle. Because at some point it also gets so invisible that it's hard for you to see it too.
So what do you tell people who have fallen and had like a bad fall and they're kind of shaken with their, like how they feel about it and have a hard time getting back on, so that they don't stop and they continue to go on?
Smaller steps. Usually people criticize themselves for having the feeling of fear. And then they also push themselves to, like, let's just use the get back in the saddle again so the horse doesn't learn a bad experience. Mm-hmm. Well, either it was some totally random thing, like you were on a trail and your horse tripped and you both fell or rolled, or either it's something like so random, mm-hmm. or you were probably missing a lot of warning signs, like you were missing, and then your horse was, you know, you've been, maybe my horse is bucking. Well, it was a little buck. Well, it was a little rear. Well, like, so it tends to be one extreme or the other. Either it was truly random, mm-hmm. and it tripped over a root and you both just about fell and you fell off, or you were missing signs. So either way, to build your confidence, you have to go to smaller steps. And I've been like, I know I sound like a crazy person. Go lunge your horse and don't get on. Mm-hmm. Go and don't get on for 10 days in a row. Go out there and do all this stuff and don't get on. And then on day 11, get on and get right back off. Don't get on until you are like almost frustrated that you're not on. Like, mm-hmm. why am I still holding back?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, just mm-hmm. literally hold yourself back until you want to go forward versus mm-hmm. forcing yourself on before you're ready. Because a lot of times, because the majority of the time, it's actually, most of the time, it's more likely that something was being missed versus the tripping on the trail thing. Mm-hmm. That happens, but a lot of times you've been missing something. You look at everything different after you've actually been in kind of an accident. Mm-hmm. So you might see a lot more during your groundwork and your prep, but you're not going to see it if all you do is throw the saddle on and head off down the trail. Because that's a big step. I wouldn't do that with a colt. You wouldn't be like, oh, you got a brand new colt. You saddled it today. Let's head off down the trail.
Yeah.
Start adding all those steps, like in that book, in the Smart Start, start adding all those steps back in. And all of a sudden you're like, I remember when I was bending and doing that, and I used it like a checklist and was like, did that once. My horses aren't did that once. Mine are like, they need to own it any day of the week that I pull them out right now, automatic. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of Smart Start, another viewer asked, in Smart Start, you talk about bringing a horse into emotional balance and then making them a zero. I understand how to take the unresponsive horse at a negative 10 and get him going, but getting back to plus 10, back down to zero, is always a much greater challenge. Can you provide some more examples or additional advice on how to accomplish this?
Mm-hmm. Another way to look at the plus 10 and minus 10 is sensitizing and desensitizing. So when you've got the negative 10 horse, he's really dull. So we're trying to sensitize him. So people tend to understand that because they're thinking maybe we're going to use the riding crop. We're going to use a cue, like I'm going to squeeze you. And if you don't go, then I'm going to go to another escalating cue, and it goes up like that. The opposite side is desensitizing. So it would be bringing the horses down through the phases. So desensitizing that you see a lot would be when you're sacking them out with a bag, or when you're sacking them out with the stick and string, you're sacking them out to noise. So what changes there a little bit is people get confused about the idea. People tend to, And people go through these stages of learning with the horses. And a lot of times I say that if you just want to, like, we'll just make this up. So this person gets a horse and they're riding it and they're not really, they don't know anything about sensitizing or desensitizing. They've just watched some cowboy movies and they got on a horse once upon a time at somebody's house. They get a horse, they go down the trail. They just kind of pull and kick and make it happen. Believe it or not, they're doing a lot of desensitizing because they're not that concerned about finesse. They're just kind of like manually, like left, right. They're just kind of manually doing things. Mm-hmm. So because they're not focused on the details, think about a kid's horse. Like, kids' horses will like drag their young riders' reins out of their hands and go eat grass, right? So, but you know what? That young rider is not thinking like, "Oh no, is this bit causing the horse pain? Yeah. Did I use too much leg right there? Was I asking for too much?" The young rider is like, "Charge! I want to go catch my friend." And the pony the young rider, that green rider, is kind of desensitizing because they're not that focused on it. Well, then what happens usually in the next stage is that the rider becomes more aware for some reason, whether they're attending events or educational things or whatever, but then they start to really focus and then they start to sensitize a lot. And so they start to be really detail oriented and they start to get the horse really sensitive because they're really good at pressure and release. So the kid didn't care. The kid was just dragging the pony around. So they were desensitizing. Yeah. So a lot of times when people are getting the horse too sensitive, you almost challenge them, like, seriously, act like you're a 6-year-old that just got a new pony. Wow. Like, run. I'm going to hug you. I'm going to hang on your neck. I'm going to carry balloons. Yeah. I'm going to go grab my dog and like drag him along the side. Like, when you have this, now, thankfully, as adults, we can call it controlled chaos. But if you think about it a little bit like that, so the desensitizing that a lot of people have when they're hot is groundwork. I think people have covered really well. I think you see a lot of people covering, like, you know, whipping and flags and bags and stuff. But you have to take that same concept of dulling them out and you have to apply it to your leg. Your leg can't only be a fire stick. It can't only be like, go. It has to mean some other things. So that's why, like, on my horses, I'll teach my horses that I can wave my legs at their shoulder and teach them to back up. Well, all of a sudden, this horse now thinks, oh, legs can mean go forward and legs can mean back up. Now the horse doesn't only have forward. Like, when people say my horse is scared of a whip, well, I think, again, in groundwork, people are getting more and more understanding that you can desensitize or sensitize with the whip. That applies to every single tool you have, your legs, your hands, your voice, everything. It applies to everything, that concept of balance. And so you'll notice there's some people that are naturally really good at dulling horses out because of the way that they are with horses. And there's other people that are naturally making horses really sensitive. That's because of who they are. And what happens is you typically see it best magnified if you have a sensitive horse paired with a person that naturally tends to sensitize, because then all of it goes off to one side and gets out of balance. And all that means is that person has to learn the other side of the scale, how to desensitize. Mm-hmm.
So I do notice, like, with a lot that you do a lot of playtime with the little ones. How do you get them to play without it making it dangerous?
Now, when I'm doing it, I'm trying to describe. So as the horse has to earn the right to be closer to me. So I don't have enough videos because I never think to have the video camera out when I've got a weanling there. Because when the weanlings come in, I do stuff with them, but I usually keep them for like short time periods. If we didn't raise them, then they're there for short time periods. And even mine, like, I bring them in, mess with them, and then throw them back in the pasture. Like, I just don't do that much with them. It's like, it's good, and they could be handled for vet and farrier and that kind of stuff, but I don't do a lot with them. So I never think to grab the camera. But it's funny because when I lead the babies, I keep them much more at that 4 foot. Like, if a stick and string is about 4 feet long, I keep the babies about 3 to 4 feet away from me, which is pretty much the opposite of what most people do. Most people would be like, you know, like all over them. And so the more they know, the closer I let them get to me, because physically it's more risky for both of us. And they ask a lot more questions about biting and chewing on you, the more they feel like they're comfortable in your space. Now, it looks, you will find video footage from when I adopted the two babies from Last Chance Corral, where it looks like I was overly cuddly with them. But they sort of are, they were sort of in a different camp, because you got to think, they're without their mothers, and I'm literally like bucket feeding them. And so they were by far the most handled babies I had. But I also was carrying a stick and string when I was leading them and backing them out of my space using their cannon bones, all the same stuff that I was doing with anyone that was older. It was just a little more magnified time, because I couldn't just throw them out in the pasture with their moms, because I was having to do all that mom stuff too.
So your husband's a trainer as well. Do you find that different horses respond to each of you differently? Or can you train the same horse and you don't notice any difference?
Oh, there's like so many angles of where you could answer this. So I think at the end of the day, it's like having two different teachers that are teaching the same concepts and in a very same way. Like, so we're very similar. And so it's pretty easy for us to move between horses. But years ago, when we used to train a lot of horses, we used to keep 17 to 20 horses in training full time. And so at that time, we would split the string in half. And so I was riding half the horses, he was riding half the horses. And every once in a while, we'd be like, you know, oh man, you know, like, you know, you're really good at teaching the spin, why don't you do a little bit of this? And you're really, you know, he'd be like, you're really good with the lead change, you do this. And we played around with it. And what's interesting is, we ended up coming up with our own rule of, like, if we're going to trade horses when we're in this intense training phase, then it's got to be for a minimum of a couple weeks. Because what happens is, the horses always learn grandma's rules, which is they move to the point of whatever somebody will let them do. Mm-hmm. We didn't run into grandma's rules a lot, but what we ran into was, it's almost like listening to somebody talk with an accent. There's a little bit of a difference between us. And there was a lag time. It's like, there's a reason why kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade kids don't change classrooms. Because the consistency at that point of their life is better, more valuable to have the consistent teacher. But we do want to get them to the point where they do start changing classrooms and changing to different teachers, because that's another valuable lesson. So if the horse was real early on, Jesse and I just said, if we're going to trade, now, if I just wanted to be like, I want to see what it looks like. But this was pre-iPhone. Now we just go, I want to see what it looks like. I'm like, I whip out my iPhone, hold it up and go, show me. And we just do it like that. Uh-huh. And so so we don't tend to, because I think it's a little less consistency for the horse if you change riders every other day, even though we're so similar. So that's a long answer to a short, like something I probably could have said shorter.
Yeah. So speaking of grades and things like that, how do you choose when a horse is ready to qualify for a higher education in your in your table that you created in Smart Start?
Basically, you're always teaching and looking for the holes. So you're moving up through now. It goes back to something I said earlier, like things usually feel 80% done and then you're moving on. And I think that when people come and take a clinic from me, I think sometimes that's a little bit like, but I want to get it perfect. And you're like, okay, we're going to get it 80% done, because as you learn the next concept, it actually helps finish out that earlier concept. That's just how learning works. It keeps stretching you a little higher across the board, but there's also a lot of going back. So it's easier to put that into an example. So it might be like, I might be moving along and so Smart Start only goes to a certain point, and then there's so much. So let's just jump way ahead into like lead changes. It's like, okay, my horse has pretty good forward motion. I can walk, I can trot, I can canter easy. I can go from a walk to a canter pretty easy. You know, all this is happening pretty good. And then I start adding more things. Well, what's going to happen is at some point, I'm going to hit a point of resistance. Like I'm going to lope off on the left lead and move the horse's hip, and I'm going to ask for a lead change and nothing's going to happen. Well, when nothing happens, I'm going to have to be like, okay, what didn't the horse understand? Did it slow down? Did it not move away from my right leg or my left leg? Did it get stiff in its face? And then I have to actually go back and work on whatever the answer to, let's say it slowed down, like because of the way that I opened one leg, it thought maybe this is a slowdown cue. It's a lazier horse. And so it slowed down. And so I think, oh, geez, I got to work better. I got to go back and reinforce a lower exercise that's going to actually make this higher exercise more likely to happen the next time. So it's basically I'm constantly moving up and down the scale.
Yeah,
that's how I kind of feel. I actually have a 10-month-old right now. So this whole, like, I've been reading your one book. One of my friends actually let me have it for right now because we're starting her from the ground up. So it's definitely, you're really an inspiration to a lot of us to try and do all of that, because I feel like we're going backwards right now.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. Well, I'm glad you're finding it helpful. But so what the 10-month-old is, what are you doing right now?
So we're just trying to get her to kind of stay away from us, because she loves to, like, jump on you. I don't know where she got that from, but she likes to be really close to you. So we're trying to get her to kind of give us our space. She's going to be a barrel horse. I have a 7-year-old too as well that we're, like, training, and she's a barrel horse too. So that's our goal.
Yep. Yep. So the, generally the jumping on and that pushing stuff, it's, if you watch them with their moms, if you watch them with their playmates, that's what they do. The very first, I have an email sign up, like, newsletter. It's not a newsletter. It's a weekly email with tips, training tips that goes out. And the very first video that I send out in there, it's like, it's short. It's a couple minutes, but it's three horses in the round pen. And it's one that's clearly dominant, and two that are actually, at the time, I think they were a yearling and a 2-year-old, but they're very closely matched, like, emotionally or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they're just all over each other. They're just banging and climbing, and you can't tell who's who. That's how they ask the questions. But you know what's funny? You watch both of them banging around there, and nobody bangs into popcorn because they've been in the pasture with them, and they know you don't bang into popcorn. So it's when they're banging into you and doing that stuff, like, even in the pasture, they learn who not to bang into real fast, because it's whoever follows through with the corrections and doesn't feel guilty about doing it. So, yeah.
With you being, like, consistent and with training and everything, have you ever felt like you just wanted to give up, feeling like nothing felt like it was going anywhere?
I remember early on in the training, the only time that I really felt like that, because I've always loved horses so much that the idea of giving up horses never left, but the idea of not being a professional distinctly occurred, because there's a pressure when you take a client's horse. Mm-hmm. So, like, me training my own horse, I've always been very, like, fluid with the idea that I love horses and I'm going to do something with you. Mm-hmm. So give me a mini, I'm going to find something to do with the mini. Give me Presto, the Last Chance Corral baby, who's now 16 and over 16 hands. And I'm like, well, you're not a reiner. We know this. Like, I'm open and fluid to what it means. But at the same time, as a professional, you had all the pressure from the owners to be like, it's bred to do reining. It's supposed to be a superstar. It's your job to make it that.
Right.
And so I think I see owners that personally apply that same pressure to themselves. So a person could do that to themselves. They could be like, I'm failing my horse. That'd be why that podcast happened. I'm failing my horse. I need to do this. And nothing good comes out of that energy, because, I mean, you end up putting all these weird restrictions on it, where it's like, every day I'm going to go out and I'm going to fail forward. I'm going to make mistakes in the right direction. I'm going to make a mistake. I'm going to ask for the lead change, thinking I might work. It's not going to work. And I'm not going to think, oh my gosh, this horse knows I was going for a lead change today. So now tomorrow he's going to know, oh, that was lead change coming. And so we're never changing leads for the rest. The horse doesn't have a clue what I'm asking. The horse was like, we're loping, and now she's pushing on this other leg, and I'm confused, so I'm going to slow down, because in the past, like, she hasn't liked me running off, so I'm going to slow down. But I'm not thinking that this horse is running away in these kind of, I think people put a lot of mischievous, or that's almost not even aggressive enough, because I don't think about it like this. But a lot of people apply the thoughts that the horse is trying to do something, like it's going to hold the idea that if you don't get back on, you've now done something wrong. If you ask for the lead change and you don't get it, you've done something wrong. Mm-hmm. And most of the time, like, you didn't say to the horse, like, today we're doing lead changes.
Yeah.
And on the third one, we're going to, like, the horse is just like, I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
Even getting on the trailer, anything that humans can clearly see the end to, humans tend to make into one big pass or fail. Like, it didn't get on the trailer. It did get on the trailer. Well, you know, it's not, it actually can be broken down so much smaller than that. You know, if how you approach the trailer, if you can approach the trailer so much smoother, maybe you just end there.
Yeah.
If you get the two front feet on the trailer and get back out, that doesn't mean you can't ever ask for a third foot. It just means that you decided you were done for the day versus the horse calling it quits and then you not knowing how to handle it.
That's good.
That is good.
So we want to know, what are you working on now with, like, your horses, yourself? What's next?
Yay! I'm having so much fun. I've decided, kind of like when I did the Stacey's Video Diary Jack, I decided that I wanted to, I kept saying, people don't understand how long it takes. And then I was like, well, that's because nobody shows them how long it takes. You know, you sort of like see a horse pop up at a show and you're like, wow, it must have been a good one. And you're like, no, it's been like 3 years of really hard work.
Yeah.
But it's hard to document 3 years of really hard work. So what I'm doing this year is I'm going to do a lot more of kind of the opposite. And the Stacey's Video Diary Jack was, here's a horse that hasn't been started. Here's the steps in the process. And I took him all the way from unstarted to his first show, and you can watch a lot, like there's 40 different ones or something like that show this. This year, I'm going to take Willow and Gabby's never been shown, and she's a granddaughter of Roxy, and Willow has been shown, she was shown twice last year, so basically like really light, and I'm documenting what I'm doing this year. My goal is to go to the Western Dressage World Show in October,
Nice.
And I want to show and document and talk about the process of, what does that mean I'm doing at home? How do I know when to go to a show? How do I decide whether that show was a success or a failure, or what did I get out of that show? And do I go to the next show or do I skip the next show? And do I ask for more? Do I ask for less? And all the things that happen in between. Oh no, it needs time off because it's foot sore. Oh no, Stacy hurt her back and she can't ride this week. You know, because there's so much of life that's happening before you get to the world show. And people feel like when life happens to them, they're like, oh no, I can't go to the world show in October because, you know, all of this feels like it's falling apart. Yeah, right. And I'm here to say, like, it basically feels like it's falling apart the whole time as we're going to it.
That's good. That's good for all of us to hear about.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll be taking a short break. And when we get back, we will enter our next segment, Canter Banter.
Our next segment, Canter Banter, is brought to you by Ram Horse Fencing and Stalls, the one-stop shop for your horse farm. Ram is family-owned and operated and has been in business for over 30 years. We welcome you to call in and speak with an expert about your next project today at 866-653-8984. Again, that's 866-653-8984.
And we're back. On this Canter Banter discussion, Janaea has a little story for us.
Okay, so I know you rode Roxy in your freestyle bridleless and saddleless ride that you had. So I remember watching it when I was 13. I'm 20 now, so it was like 7 years ago. And I had a black horse as well. And I was like, I'm going to do that same thing. And so I took my sister out with me. I'm like, hey, let's do this, video this. And she's like, okay. So I got on my black horse. And mind you, she's barrel horse. She's kind of crazy. Like, so we got out in the paddock and started riding. And I was like, I'm just going to do this, you know. And she took off because when you kick her, she goes, like, sprints. And she took off, and I was like, okay, this is not working. And she got a video, and I fell off. Like, I didn't have a helmet on, and I was like, that was definitely not what Stacey Westfall did at all. Like, no way. I don't know what I was thinking. But I was
she
like,
felt
yeah.
Good, huh?
I
Doing
did fall
when
good.
You got on, it felt like you were going to do it.
I got back on. I did get back on, but I got back on with a saddle and a bridle instead.
Yeah.
Better choice.
Yes. So I've had a fair number of those stories, like more than I can count right off the top of my head. Some have ended most have ended very similar to yours. One was a trainer, and I was at an expo, and the trainer came up and was like, and it was dragging like a 16-year-old girl with him and was like, tell her what you did. And he was like, I'll tell you my side first. She finishes her riding lesson and she comes into the aisleway and she goes, hey, do you mind if I go ride, whatever the horse's name was, just a little bit in the arena? And he says, sure, go ahead. And he goes, next thing I know, she's yelling to me because she has a broken leg.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
And so, and it was a reining horse, and it was, it was trained, but it's not the same thing even then.
Yeah, definitely
but
not.
I did you know I grew up barrel racing?
I did, and that's when I started following you, and yeah, that happened, and I was like, "More, I need more training. I need to be in an English saddle before I do this."
So 10 years before my freestyle ride, so 10 years before that, the thought of bridleless even occurred to me, like, I got run off with my barrel horse, because I was thinking I should work my way towards bridleless. So I took her out of her combination Hackmore gag bit and into a halter and then headed down the road and like a few miles away from home. And it wasn't just any halter. I had bought one at the tack store where I near where I lived. They had a used tack corner. And they had one of those really fancy Arabian halters. You know, the really thin one that's really pretty.
Yeah.
It was like pretty halter. Yeah. We didn't stop. Like she ran and I've gone back and clocked it, and it's not a mile, but it felt like 10 miles, but it's close to a mile. And it was on a back road, dirt road, and she was running full out. And there was just nothing. And I was like clinging on her neck, and I was thinking, either I'm going to fall off and break my leg, or I'm going to jump off and break my leg. Oh. I might as well see if I can stay on, because that one I might not break my leg.
Yeah.
So, and she eventually like left the other horse in the dust and like finally slowed down to make a 90-degree turn that had a downhill. And so she knew the road, and so she went to slow down, and she literally broke to like an extended trot. And at that point, I bailed. I was bareback, of course.
Oh, wow.
And so I bailed at that point and did the emergency dismount where you hold the mane and you bail, but you're still like holding the mane and you're like running beside them and like led her home. It was like, that was a horrible, horrible, horrible idea. Which is, I actually think, why I did never try the bridleless earlier, because it was so walled off in my head, like, don't do this.
I think I needed better leg skills than anything. I think that's what it was.
Yeah.
Well, all right. We hope you enjoyed listening to our podcast and encourage you to share with all your equestrian family and friends. You can tune into the Late Night Riders podcast show every Friday night. Each episode will be uploaded exclusively on YouTube, where you can subscribe to our channel to stay up to date with all of our latest shows. Do you have a topic you'd like to discuss? We want to hear from you. You may email us at ram@ramfence.com or feel free to leave a comment below. Thank you again for listening.
Thank you, Stacey. Thank you.
You're welcome.